Support comes from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado, a proud partner of the public broadcasting stations that keep Coloradans better informed.
Welcome to Outsources. This evening, we're going to talk about the elections. And you may say, oh, no, I've already heard everything about the elections. But you really haven't. What's the impact on the queer community? And where are we? Where have we been and where are we going? I don't know that many people in the mainstream media have really focused on us beyond maybe a sentence or two, or maybe actually a paragraph. So I wanted to invite two people that I think are really good thinkers and have experience in this area to shed a little insight, something to just think about focusing in on our community and the elections and implications for us now and in the immediate and possibly longer term future. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and with me, we have Dr. Glenda Russell, a recently retired psychologist who now spends her time doing research and writing in queer politics and lots of other things. And Daniel Ramos, who just recently left the One Colorado executive directorship, where he's been there for almost 10 years. He has a lot of history in lots of different places before that and lots to come. So welcome, Glenda and Daniel. And could you say just a bit more about yourselves for our listeners?
I've only retired my practice. I'm doing lots of other things and really spending a lot of time doing research. And some of that research is on Boulder queer history. I've been a community historian for quite a while and have a little more time to pursue that these days.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. And I spent the last 10 years at One Colorado, the Colorado's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization, and just recently left. And am now still working in Colorado, leading an organization that's focused on protecting democracy and expanding our civic engagement ecosystem.
Let's just start just stepping back, looking at the big picture, and then maybe we can focus back down in as we go. Let's talk about the big issues. We waited and waited and got a presidential result, but there's a lot of other issues besides the presidency, as if that isn't huge enough and breaking some barriers with our new vice president. But there are many issues in terms of the Senate and the House and many initiatives across the country as well as in Colorado that touch on all of our lives. What are maybe points that stand out for you, Glenda, that just struck you as you're looking more broader picture?
In terms of the national scene, and with specific regard to LGBTQ people, I think one of the things that struck me most of all was that according to exit polling, and that's shaky this year especially. It's always shaky. It's shaky this year especially. But according to exit polling so far, we have estimates that 28% of LGBTQ people voted for Donald Trump for president. That's about twice the percentage, again, according to exit polls from 2016, who voted for him the first time. And that is one of the most mysterious figures that I've seen. I've seen it quoted many places. The source of that is a good polling source. And I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I have some thoughts, but that's the thing that sort of knocks me in the head. And we, again, as I said, exit polling is always a little slippery. And there's some indication this year for polling in general that there was a lie factor, that people who were voting for Trump didn't say that. That would certainly explain some of what happened with the polling pre-election. So again, I think it's a sloppy figure. That 28% is a sloppy figure, but it's probably in the ballpark somewhere. And it's a curious phenomenon.
So no matter what, it sounds like more queers voted for Trump second time around than first time around. And that's shocking to you.
I mean, it's not shocking exactly, but I would have expected it. I would not have been surprised to have seen it, you know, hovering around the 13, 14, 15% that we saw in the 2016 election, that it went up so far, given the many, many anti-LGBTQ things that came out of that administration, and especially anti-trans actions that came out of that administration, it was pretty surprising to me that that many people would cast their ballot for that administration. Daniel, do you have any thought about that?
Yeah, I think what I'm most curious about actually is we saw that with a number of demographics. You know, we saw that, you know, white women, we saw an increase in the vote for Trump. We saw that with men of color, and we saw it with LGBTQ folks. And so I think one of the pinpoints for that is that, you know, we also know that more people voted than ever before. President-elect Joe Biden will be the president who has the most votes ever in the history of our country. So, you know, there's perhaps more people voting as one piece to that. And then I also think that, you know, there were just some huge messages this year about what was really on the ballot and who people believed were, you know, going to handle many of the issues. I'm dumbfounded by the fact that more LGBTQ voters voted for Donald Trump, given, you know, what we're seeing with the handling of the coronavirus, the stripping away of many protections for the LGBTQ community, the dismantling of so many of our institutions like the courts or the election, for example. And so that is one piece for me that I think a lot of people will study, as we saw that with a number of demographics, including LGBTQ folks, and increasing their vote share this year for Donald Trump compared to 2016.
Yeah, I'm guessing based on some of the exit polling, including with people of color who also had surprisingly high percentages for Trump, that the economy is certainly one of the things that people are hooking their votes on, and it's going to be complicated. And as you say, it's going to be studied, and we'll see. I think it's interesting that a recent Williams Institute study concluded that something like 40% of LGBT Republicans wish they were straight, and 38% of LGBT Republicans said that they regarded their sexuality as a character flaw. I think there's an interesting intersection between the political and the psychological that's going on, as well as all kinds of other issues that are going on. But I do think that there's probably some interplay between how queer people feel about themselves as queer people and who they're willing to let handle the country are concerned.
Well, I hadn't actually seen that study, but it's incredibly surprising. I mean, I think one of the things that we're seeing, is if you're not a, you know, straight white middle upper class man in this country, you almost don't succeed. And we've seen that time and time and time again. And so what I'm hopeful for is that now with, you know, the most, you know, diverse pool of candidates we've ever seen run for office, where we've seen more LGBTQ candidates, more folks of color, you know, with our vice president-elect Kamala Harris as the first woman of color to hold that office, that we can see that people can actually do it. The last 4 years has just been sort of attack after attack in this piece of recognizing that who we are and who we love definitely impacts what opportunities we have. And so I'm curious if, you know, folks who in that study had internalized some of the challenges that they had in their own lives and thinking that it was a character flaw, when in fact it's a true asset of, you know, we have incredibly unique experiences, the things that we bring, the background, even thinking about empathy and how we lead and how we understand and how we listen in ways that, you know, we have unique experiences that should really be cherished, because they are a way that we view the world, and they help, you know, bring forth different decisions, different experiences, and it ultimately helps to, you know, better policies and hopefully moving some of these issues forward.
Absolutely. I to echo that and to expand on a little differently, you know, of the LGBTQ people, we have an enormous increase in LGBTQ elected officials as a result of this election, and in very unlikely places, like Oklahoma elected a non-binary Black Muslim millennial to the state house. We have the first state Senate trans person in the country. That's from Delaware. I mean, and we saw those gains really pretty broadly and pretty in sort of expected places like New York, but also really unexpected places like Kansas and Oklahoma. And one of the things that seems to be happening is that where we have people on the ground in local elections, where the voters can actually get to know those people, they end up electing them. Because they see the kinds of qualities that you're talking about, but you have to sort of see them up close and see something other than the stereotype and the fantasy of what queer people are in order to get that kind of electoral action. But it is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think to that point, you know, it really is about the real on the ground investment, right? And organizations led by Black and Brown folks, by organizations that led by women. And so it is really thinking about that pipeline, that it really begins with the grassroots, where, right, you know, our volunteers are now our elected officials. And that is an experience that they bring. And so to make sure that with that representation also means that we can fund the organizations doing the on the ground work, the year round civic engagement and community engagement work that needs to be done. Because as we're even seeing in Georgia right now, you know, where we have two runoff elections that could determine the majority of the U.S. Senate, where we are seeing that some of the investments made in, you know, 2016 and 2018 and some of the work that continues to be done, especially in communities of color in Georgia, may actually, in fact, help elect Joe Biden and also flip the U.S. Senate.
When you look at the people elected across the country, according to the Victory Fund, there's supposed to be 863 elected officials at some level of government. That would include judges as well as city councils. There's a lot more people at the local levels rather than at the national levels moving up. But you can see the pipeline is starting to happen where people get experience in their city councils or other areas, whether volunteer or staff or whatever, and they're starting to make their way slowly, slowly upward and into the system. And maybe with more and more people voting, with the opportunities of early voting, and hopefully states will start catching on that it's a really good idea to do early voting as well as mail-in ballots, more and more people can actually exercise their right to have their voice heard and maybe feel more engaged.
I think that's a really important observation. I mean, one of the things that the Victory Fund press releases have been saying also is that a significant proportion of LGBTQ elected officials are also people of color, much more than in the general population, in the population of general elected officials. And I think that demonstrates our own commitment to intersectionality, something that we have to keep going at. And I think we have this is an opportune time to do that. But a piece of that is a very hopeful thing for queer people. And that is we can have real impact locally and in states. And we really need to put our energy into doing that. No matter who is driving this bus, this bus has a lot of places where we can fit in and keep creating that pipeline. And so when people think they're not doing much to change things, if they're working on the local level at all, they are doing a whole lot to change things.
Yeah, I think that's one of the exciting things we're seeing right now is, you know, if you look at our LGBT caucus here in Colorado, we now have, you know, we'll have 8 openly LGBT elected officials in the next legislative session. And if you think about where those folks come from, you know, working with Representative Leslie Harrod, you know, she and I work together at, on the board of New Era Colorado, which engages young voters, and you know, Danaya Esgar, who's now the new majority leader of the state house, was a activist in Pueblo, and then you know, was one of her and her partner Heather were one of our messenger couples around civil unions, and Representative Brianna Tatone, you know, our state's first openly LGBT elected official, talks about coming to LGBTQ Lobby Day at One Colorado, and that was really how she found her voice. And so it is this example where, one, Colorado continues to lead by having a great representation in our legislature of openly LGBTQ elected officials, and seeing where those people come from. The second point is that the other place where Colorado continues to lead is on our election system. You know, we had our election system essentially was on display this year because we've been an all-male ballot state since 2013. And when folks were figuring out how to do this, folks looked to our Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, and her leadership in making sure that they could, you know, lean on her and the work that she's done around having safe and secure elections. And so what I'm hoping is that, you know, we now see what mail-in voting looks like, that people all across this country, because of this pandemic, were able to experience. You know, there were many, many complications in terms of getting access to a ballot and making sure that it counted. But we know that it works. We know that it's safe, it's secure, and it's fair. You know, pushing forward the Colorado model, where, you know, we know and we've proven that year after year, mail-in ballots work, and we've seen incredible turnout. In Colorado, for example, nearly 86% of people turned out to vote. It's huge. And so the more accessible our elections are, the more people vote.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and my guest, Dr. Glenda Russell, psychologist, researcher, writer, and historian of queer politics, and Daniel Ramos, who recently left his position of 10 years as the One Colorado Executive Director, which is a statewide advocacy network, and has moved even more deeply into the civic engagement systems. We've been talking about the big issues, looking at exit polling, as well as the political and psychological interface, and looking at the pipeline, and moving into talking about local politics as well. Continuing on a bit with the local piece, it's really good news that all of our queer folks in the legislature got reelected. And one person, Sonia Hawkins Lewis, moved from the House to the Senate in Colorado's legislature. And then we added David Ortiz, who's a coming into the House of Representatives from District 38. So it's exciting that we're building. We're not going backwards. People didn't get thrown out of office. It's great. And like you were saying also, Glenda, people get to know each other and feel good about their representative on not just saying, oh, this is a person who's in the LGBTQ only community, but broader. Although I do understand Representative Titone certainly took some mudslinging her way.
Ooh. Yeah, she really did. And we know when that happens that it has an impact not only on her and bless her for keeping up the good fight, but it does on other people as well who are trans, and indeed I would say other people who are queer as well as trans. And we have to know how to push back against that and take care of ourselves and support her in particular, despite the fact that there were, in essence, anti-gay hate crimes committed against her during her campaign.
Yeah, you know, just the rhetoric, you know, as we're sort of seeing what, you know, some of the attacks that we saw on our legislators this year, and knowing that, you know, there were many, you know, many Republicans this year who stood up for LGBTQ issues in the state legislature. And so, you know, as more and more folks understand who LGBTQ people are, they see them in the legislature, they're sitting across the tables from them, having these conversations, talking about them and their families and the things that matter to them, that, you know, that what we saw really was a desperate attempt by Republicans this year to try to unseat Representative Breonna Titone. And it was, you know, it was just a complete disgrace, really, when you think about it. And what was good to see is there were some Republicans that actually spoke out. There were some people that did talk about how this is not, you know, a conservative value, that it really was coming from this desperate place where Republicans were trying to win the seat, and they did it through, you know, trans.
Yeah, I think it kind of harkens back to Glenda's research back on Amendment 2, that how much all that negative rhetoric reverberates through the community and makes people not feel good. And the more people who are allies, or at least people who are more aware that this is way out of line, are able to say something or intervene, no matter who they are or what their issues are, that they can see this isn't the way we want to be. I think that was part of what was on the election ballot for some people, at least, is who are we as a country? Who are we as a state? Who are we as a city? Who do we want to be?
And one of the things that happens with that, you know, as Daniel was saying, Republicans as well as Democrats, as well as people in general, stood up for Breonna Titone that sends a powerful message, and literally it really contributes to changing norms, so that those kinds of actions, that kind of rhetoric, no longer becomes permissive, acceptable, and people stop doing it. And that's a profound change.
And welcome.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the last few minutes that we have left, what else do you think we need to be thinking about besides the Senate election runoffs in Georgia? You know, what else do we need to be thinking about for our community? What gives you hope?
What I can start with is, you know, where I think things are going to be exciting is that, you know, we know that the Biden transition team has already started putting the pieces back together of what Trump destroyed in a lot of ways. And what we know for many of those things are many protections for LGBTQ folks, whether it's trans youth in schools or protecting people from discrimination in insurance or ensuring that LGBTQ young people aren't discriminated against in cases of foster or adoption, that there are all these things that we can put back together. And I'm excited for that, for us to piece those things back together and also to imagine what more needs to be in place. I think the second thing that I'll really leave with is just really this reminder that, like, remember what this feeling is like. You know, what I think a lot about is that for many folks, perhaps, you know, we may have taken democracy for granted. We had no idea how fragile this institution truly is. And the way that people have gone about to try to take away the right for people to vote. And so what I'm really hoping we go from here is this renewed sense of who we are as a democracy, that it's worth fighting for. We must participate in it. We must do everything to make it more accessible. And now with some of the wins that we've had, to make sure that we actually go deeper, to make sure that we fight harder, that we continue to volunteer, we continue to give, and we make sure that our organizations and our people are sustained and that they're around to make sure that we can continue to advocate for a democracy that truly represents and values everyone.
Specifically, what I'm most excited about is seeing the Department of Education rules and regulations change dramatically over the next year. I think they have to. We have basically pushed trans students out of the picture in every possible way, and I think that will be replaced. I really am hopeful about that, and I'm so relieved and so glad. I also think the Department of Justice has to stop being the personal lawyer for the president and get back into the business of justice. The DOJ has been an important source of social change in this country and supporting civil rights, and that's its mission. And that needs to be what it does. I echo what you said, Daniel, about what we've learned about democracy. You know, we were warned as a group after Obergefell that it wasn't time to go home. And many people did go home and go, okay, things are taken care of. And we got a big wake-up call on this one. In fact, I think I would say that democracy is more fragile than we thought. And honestly, today I'm thinking it's stronger than we thought, too. It's at least stronger than I thought. And I think we have to really work hard to keep that strength. And that means changing some laws around presidential power. I mean, it's really time to do that, and to be careful with that. And I also think that for queer people in particular, we have got to start a major, massive campaign to educate people about the place of religion in public life and the importance of religion in public life, and how religion in public life should not give people a pass to disobey the laws that everybody else has to obey. And I think with the current composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, that's going to be really one of the most important things we can put our energy into doing. That's a norm that has to change. And it's a norm that can change, because it used to be one way and it got pushed into this direction, and we need to push it back and say that everybody has to follow laws. And having deeply held religious beliefs does not give you that permission. But I also think the other message is act locally. It changes the world. And you can be a part of an incredibly exciting prospect of strengthening democracy at a time that it needs to be rebuilt.
I'm very excited about the fact how many people voted for the first time in the history of our country, and hoping that broadens out. And I'm excited at how many new people ran for office at the local and state levels and got elected. And then I'm excited about all the diversity that that brings into the legislatures, as well as city councils and county governments, and how that's going to strengthen what all of our communities look like and the health of all of our communities. And finally, I would just remind people that we did have a big election, but as Warm Cookies of the Revolution always says, we vote every day for what we support and what we don't. And that it's a democracy, and it means you work all the time on keeping it healthy and alive for all of us to enjoy. Thank you, Daniel. And thank you, Glenda. I really appreciate you taking some time out from this crazy time and giving us your thoughts. It's really important for us to think of many of the issues you actually laid out on the table and congratulate ourselves. And like you say, Daniel, feel good about it. Take that in your heart and use it to empower ourselves to move forward and make this the country we want to live in.
Thanks for inviting us.
You're very welcome.
Absolutely. Great to be with you both.
And Daniel, I have to say, I didn't interrupt you when you were talking, but when you were talking about all the changes in Colorado, one of the thoughts that was foremost in my mind is you're responsible for a lot of those.
We welcome you all. Outsources every Monday night at 6:30, or get it at kgnu.org, outsources, or on the blog, news.kgnu.org. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. You've been listening to Glenda Russell and Daniel Ramos, and we are happy to take your feedback if you have any. We're all ears. Stay well. Good evening.